This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Billahir rahmanir rahim. Qul inna salati wa nusuki wa mahyaya wa mamati lillahi rabbil alameen la sharika lah wa bithalika umirtu wa ana أَغَيْرَ اللَّهِ أَبْغِي رَبًّا وَهُوَ رَبُّ كُلِّ شَيْءٍ وَلَا تَكْسِبُ كُلُّ نَفْسٍ إِلَّا عَلَيْهَا ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that he might try you by what he has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and he is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. Iran says the U.S. maximum pressure campaign against Tehran will fail again as it slams Washington's sanctions targeting its drone program. Thousands of people rally in Mali's capital, Bamako, to protest French military presence in the African country. Also coming up, the U.N. envoy in Sudan urges the country's rapid support force to avoid confrontation during planned nationwide protests against the recent coup. Welcome to World News from our headquarters in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story this hour, Iran has slammed U.S. sanctions targeting its drone program. The Iranian Foreign Ministry says the latest unilateral measure against Tehran shows Washington's contradictory behavior and proves it is not trustworthy at all. The ministry spokesman said the current U.S. administration speaks of plans to rejoin the 2015 nuclear deal, while in practice, it's following in the footsteps of the previous administration. Saeed Khatibzadeh says the U.S. maximum pressure campaign against Iran has failed to realize any of Washington's goals and will not succeed in the future either. Early on Friday, the U.S. imposed fresh sanctions on several companies and individuals connected to Iran's drone program. The U.S. Treasury claims that Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has supplied lethal UAVs to resistance movements in Lebanon, Palestine, and Yemen. Scott Bennett is a former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer joining us. Scott, welcome. Is the Biden administration sincere, in your opinion, when it talks about wanting or to return to the Iran nuclear deal, when at the same time it's imposing sanctions against Iran, just like its predecessor, the Trump administration did?
Well, essential thing to understand in this policy is that this is not a policy of the American people. This is a policy of Israel and the Jewish Israeli extremist Zionists, which have captured the American government to a large extent, the State Department and the Office of Foreign Assets Control. Let's never forget that a dual Israeli citizen named Sigal Mandelker was the previous Office of Foreign Assets Control who put on sanctions against the New Horizons Conference when I was back in Iran with many other colleagues and academics and scholars. And it was this Sigal Mandelker, dual Israeli citizen, that orchestrated the arrest of Press TV journalist Marzia Hashimi and tried to extort her and engage in almost a torturous cross-examination to try and somehow, get more information on Americans that were participating in this conference. So it's essential to combat this by declaring to the American people from Iran, from the Iranian leadership and the political figures, to declare to the American people, you are under siege. This is not the Biden administration's policy. This is Israel's policy, and the Zionists that control the American government, and they are lying to the American people, and indeed, they're trying to set up for another conflict and war like they did in 2003 when Netanyahu came and lied about Iraq. This is being played all over again, American people. You need to wake up and see this, because I think the world doesn't really understand that the American people don't understand what's going on here. And it seems almost ludicrous, and I know some foreign countries and cultures and people have a little bit too much respect for the American government and people, but they really need to mature in that understanding that Americans, to a large extent, are some of the stupidest, most naive, most disconnected, most ignorant people on the planet, and at the same time, some of the most spoiled, selfish, arrogant, and militaristic, bombastic, bloodthirsty people on the planet. And I don't say this with any joy, but I say it with a lot of deliberation and experience. So really the only way to combat this is to say this proves that there is no difference between the Biden administration and the Trump administration. This proves that the American people are not in charge of their own foreign policy, that their government's been hijacked, and indeed the Israeli Zionists are positioning the American sons or daughters to be put back into a meat grinder of war against Iran that the Israelis are trying to trigger for Americans
right.
to fall into. Is this what you want? And the American people would say no.
And Scott, so if the Zionist lobbies in Washington, D.C. are the ones that started this so-called maximum pressure campaign, Iran said is saying it, that it didn't work under the former administration of Donald Trump, and it won't achieve its goals under the Biden administration. Is that something that you would go along with?
I think the Iranians are smart enough to realize that they cannot deal with a psychopathic, mentally deranged regime and government and people. And they have said that very clearly. They are not going to bend. They are not going to concede. They are not going to renegotiate. They are standing their ground. And indeed, the United States was the only country that led this nonsense of disagreement with Iran. It wasn't Britain, it wasn't France, it wasn't Germany, it wasn't Russia, it wasn't China, it wasn't any of the other nations that entered into the JCPOA. It was the Zionist-controlled, megalomaniac American government that pulled out of the agreement. Iran said, when you're ready to come back to the table, we'll be here. But we will not compromise our missile defense capability, because we've seen what you do to countries like Libya. We've seen what you do to countries like Syria. We've seen what you do to countries like Afghanistan. So we're not going to surrender our ability to defend ourselves. And at the same time, Iran has also said it has no interest in producing nuclear weapons. It has no interest in starting a war. Iran hasn't started a war since 1775. But Iran is interested in growing nuclear power, like all other nations, to prosper and flourish in the maturity of its country and for the benefit of its people. And it has every right to do that. But this is an information war. This is a psychological war. This is a public relations war and a diplomatic war. And it has to be won directly to the American people. The Iranian communication needs to split the Israeli Zionist regime stranglehold on the American people, and when it splits the Israeli Zionist control of the American people's foreign policy, they will see that the American people have never been on the side of conflict in the Middle East. They were never behind these wars stemming from 9/11, and then they've been not only, of course, the victims have been the people of the Middle East, but the American people have been a victim of this as well. Because their sons and daughters were lied to and sent to war for an Israeli Zionist agenda, and this is simply
right.
another chapter in that. So you have to divide the Israeli Zionists from
right.
the American government, and then you may have a new start.
So Scott, thank you very much indeed for your thoughts. Scott Bennett there, former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer, joining us live out of San Francisco. Now, Russia's permanent representative to the United Nations, Fazali Nebenzia, says pressuring Iran to speed up the process to resume the talks over the 2015 nuclear deal won't be helpful. Take a listen to what he had to say about Iran's preparations ahead of the seventh round of negotiations, which Tehran insists should lead to a removal of U.S. sanctions.
They were criticized that they are not quick enough to go back to negotiations. To that, I was telling our American colleagues that when Biden administration came to the White House and announced that that they are willing to resume negotiations on the JCPOA and return back to the fulfilling obligations under the agreement, we were encouraging them to do it as soon as possible. To which we were saying, look, we just came to the office, we need to review, we need to together, we need to regroup, we have to understand. And this process took a few months, by the way, before these actual negotiations resumed in various forms. Then Iran claimed the same when they had elections. They were telling till recently that they are on the verge of forming the negotiating team. But I think that, like with any other country, pressure on Iran to speed up will. The experience shows that it doesn't help. We encourage them as well. We are telling them that we have to sit down and finally do a just return to the deal.
Anti-French sentiment is running high in Mali, where thousands have come out to protest foreign military presence in the West African country. Demonstrators have flooded the streets of the capital, Bamako, waving national flags and chanting slogans against France. Some of them have set fire to the French flag. They are angry with French interference in Mali's political affairs. They also want a total withdrawal of French troops from their country.
We are here for Mali. We are here to demonstrate our national sovereignty, to remind the whole world that sovereignty belongs to the people, and that today those who have not understood this must update themselves.
France, which is Mali's former colonial ruler, has over 5,000 troops there to help fight the resurgence of extremist groups, but many in Mali consider the mission a failure. Paris now plans to reduce the number of its military personnel in Mali to 3,000. The United Nations Special Representative in Sudan has urged the country's paramilitary forces to avoid confrontation during anti-coup protests scheduled for Saturday. The UN envoy made the call during a meeting with Rapid Support Force Chief Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo. The capital, Khartoum, is bracing for major demonstrations on Saturday following deadly clashes between security forces and protesters. At least 8 people have been killed and 170 others injured over the past days. Paramilitary and army forces have been deployed across Khartoum, as well as the twin cities of Khartoum North and Omdurman. The Sudanese military staged a coup on Monday and declared a state of emergency. The move has drawn international condemnation. Political commentator Julius Balutu says the Sudanese people are fed up with military coups in their country and want a democratic government.
Just like a Sudanese citizen, I can sense the undercurrent of politics there, whereby a lot of people, Sudanese, are yearning for change, and that change means democratic rule. Remember, Sudan has been there. 17 coups have been there in the country, some successful, others not. But it's time since independence of Sudan. It's about time when I think people think they've had enough of military coups. They can see tomorrow a lot of determination on the streets of Sudan by the protesters. We are seeing right now a lot of protesters who led the revolution, which was hijacked by the military. Before, of course, the discussions, agreement for transitional government happened. We are seeing them coming back. Iconic figures, even ladies who are leading that revolution, are already, some of them are back, and definitely there will be change, because I see a situation whereby Sudanese are not relenting. They will never stop until they get civilian leadership, democratic rule, because that's what they deserve.
Relations between Saudi Arabia and Lebanon have further worsened in the wake of criticism by a Lebanese minister of the kingdom's war on Yemen. Riyadh has now decided to summon its ambassador to Lebanon for consultations. Saudi Arabia also gave the Lebanese ambassador 48 hours to leave the country. It's also imposed a blanket ban on all Lebanese imports into the kingdom. In a recent interview, the Lebanese information minister called the Saudi-led war on Yemen futile and demanded an end to it. George Ordahi said the Saudi-led coalition is bombing homes, villages, funerals, and weddings in the impoverished country. He said Yemen's Ansarullah forces are defending themselves against an external aggression. Elsewhere, thousands of U.S.-bound migrants are advancing slowly in southern Mexico, rejecting an offer to receive provisional visas to stop their journey. The caravan is made up of about 3,000 migrants from Central America and the Caribbean, mostly women and children. They began their journey last week from the southern border in Mexico in a bid to reach the U.S. An advocate for the migrants said they have been offered to dismantle the caravan in exchange for visas to settle provisionally in Mexico. However, most have rejected the offer. Washington has put pressure on Mexico to contain them before reaching the U.S. border. Previous caravans were confronted by migration agents and soldiers who are increasingly using tough tactics to stem the influx. The Canadian government has appealed a court ruling on individual welfare compensation to Indigenous children. Ottawa says it is instead working to strike a deal with the Indigenous groups by the end of the year. The government says it is putting the appeal on hold to start 2 months of settlement talks from next week. Canada's Indigenous Services Minister said the talks would focus on compensations and welfare and support systems reforms. Indigenous communities stressed that they would not leave out the issue of children's legal liabilities in the negotiations. The initial ruling required the Canadian government to pay billions of dollars in compensation to more than 55,000 Indigenous children. Ottawa appealed the ruling on Friday after a series of landmark victories for Indigenous people in recent years, long battles. That brings an end to our news bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite, words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
Senate Democrats rushed on Tuesday, 26th of October, to nail down the details of a groundbreaking tax on billionaires' wealth, part of an elaborate menu of tax increases to finance a significantly scaled-back bill that would strengthen the societal safety net and address climate change. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Jonathan Wiseman, Emily Cochrane, Alan Rappaport, Katie Edmondson, and Zolan Kano-Young. The piece is titled, Democrats Hammer Out Novel Plan to Tax Billionaires and Corporate Giants. Stay with us for more. Democrats rushed on Tuesday, 26th of October, to nail down the details of a groundbreaking tax on billionaires' wealth, part of an elaborate menu of tax increases to finance a significantly scaled-back bill that would strengthen the social safety net and address climate change. Democrats' plans to pay for about $1.5 trillion in social policy and climate spending could prove to be the most innovative components of the party's domestic legislation, a top priority which was once envisioned as a transformative cradle-to-grave initiative to vault a stagnant working class into prosperity. Now, even as President Biden and his allies cut down the plan to ensure it can pass, even with Democrats' razor-thin edge in Congress, they are toiling to agree on new tax policies that could have far-reaching consequences. Among them is a measure Senate Democrats presented on Tuesday, 26th of October, that would impose a 15% minimum tax rate on corporations based on the profits they report to their shareholders, not what they show to the Internal Revenue Service, IRS. The billionaire's tax and the corporate minimum tax face skepticism among House Democrats, who questioned their feasibility, and both were likely to encounter legal and constitutional challenges. For the first time, billionaires would face a tax on the unrealized gains in the value of their liquid assets, such as stocks, bonds, and cash, which can grow for years as vast capital stores that can be borrowed off to live virtually income tax-free. The courts would have to determine whether unrealized gains in wealth can be considered income, which the 16th Amendment allows the federal government to tax. And even if they passed legal muster, the measures were all but certain to spawn fresh tax avoidance efforts. But with Senator Kyrsten Sinema, Democrat of Arizona, a crucial holdout on President Biden's plan, serving as a one-woman blockade against more conventional tax rate increases, Democrats appear to have no choice but to turn to creative revenue measures. I've always felt that success was giving everybody in America the chance to get ahead, and what we're dealing with here are flagrant loopholes in the tax code, said Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat of Oregon and chairman of the Finance Committee. They're legal, but I'm going to close them. Democratic leaders unveiled a final bill on Wednesday, 27th of October, hoping that it would pass the House and Senate, but several sticking points remained. Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat of West Virginia, seemed to torpedo a plan that would require banks to provide the IRS with more customer account information to help catch tax cheats, calling the idea screwed up and declaring it cannot happen. Dropping it would mean that Democrats would have to find another way to raise hundreds of billions of dollars the provision was estimated to generate. Senator Kyrsten Gillibrand, Democrat of New York, was trying to line up support, including from Senator Manchin, to beef up a federally paid family and medical leave provision that had been whittled down to just 4 weeks from 12. Senator Raphael Warnock, Democrat of Georgia, threatened to withdraw his support for the bill if, as expected, it dropped a provision that would expand health care coverage for the working poor in a dozen states like his that have refused to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. Senator Bernie Sanders, independent of Vermont, was still furious over the refusal of a handful of Democrats to give Medicare board powers to negotiate prescription drug prices. But overall, liberal Democrats were trying to make their peace with a stripped-down bill that would turn a once expansive vision for social transformation into a series of short-term measures, many of which would expire under a Republican Congress if history holds and the president's party loses seats in next year's midterm elections. I'd rather we put programs out there, and if people like them, then we should continue them as a government. And if for some reason they're not popular, well then, that also helps make some determination, said Representative Mark Pocan, Democrat of Wisconsin and a leader of the Progressive House Democrats. Representative Pramila Jayapal, Democrat of Washington and the head of the Progressive Caucus, struck a pragmatic note. She said, look, the thing is, we would have been done with a very different bill a month ago if we only needed 90% of us. But that's not the case. We need 100% of us. Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, acknowledged that the package would not contain everything that President Biden wanted. But she said The alternative to what is being negotiated is not the original package. It is nothing. Democratic leaders continue to frame the legislation as transformational, an heir to Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal and Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. They lumped in its $1.5 trillion in spending with the $1.9 trillion pandemic aid bill that passed last spring and a pending $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure measure awaiting passage in the House. We're hopeful and we're optimistic about the prospects of delivering something historic, transformative, and bigger than one could possibly have imagined on behalf of everyday Americans, Representative Hakeem Jeffries of New York, chairman of the House Democratic Caucus, declared on Tuesday. Ms. Jayapal said not all the provisions had been truncated. Child care subsidies should last 6 years and home and community-based health care assistance could stretch even longer. But other measures have been cut. 2 years of guaranteed community college were jettisoned. A broad path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants was knocked out by the Senate parliamentarian. So Democratic leaders were trying to win approval to grant temporary legal status to some undocumented immigrants. Expansion of Medicare coverage to include dental, vision, and hearing care appeared likely to be cut back, if not eliminated altogether. So Senator Bernie Sanders was pushing for a $1,000 debit card as a bridge to a permanent program, particularly for dental benefits. A permanent extension of the generous child tax credit created for a year in March's pandemic relief bill was to be extended only another year. That left the tax increases that Democrats were cobbling together on the fly as potentially the most far-reaching aspect of the plan. Senator Kyrsten Sinema's refusal to accept conventional tax rate increases has played into the hands of Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts and a longtime proponent of creative measures to break through the tax avoidance strategies of the rich. These problems cannot be fixed by raising tax rates, she said. The corporate minimum tax, for instance, plays off Elizabeth Warren's long-standing efforts to force companies to pay taxes off the profits they boast about to shareholders, rather than those they minimize for tax-paying purposes. The minimum tax unveiled on Tuesday was something of a substitute for initial efforts blocked by Kyrsten Sinema to raise the corporate income tax rate to at least 25% from 21%, still far lower than the 35% rate paid before President Donald Trump's 2017 tax cut. Under the plan, companies with at least $1 billion in profits, about 200 publicly traded corporations, would no longer be able to escape income tax altogether. The 15% minimum tax would also bring the United States into compliance with a standard recently set by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, to try to root out tax havens. Senate Finance Committee aides singled out Amazon, which over the last 3 years reported $45 billion in profit, including a record $20 billion last year, but paid an effective tax rate of just 4.3%. In 2018, they said Amazon did not pay any federal income tax. Senator Angus King, independent of Maine, estimated the minimum tax would raise $300 billion to $400 billion over 10 years. Importantly, Kyrsten Sinema blessed it as a common sense step towards ensuring that highly profitable corporations pay a reasonable minimum corporate tax on their profits. The details of the billionaire's tax were being hammered out on Tuesday night. Under the plan, Congress would impose a one-time tax on all gains in the value of tradable assets held by billionaires from the time they were initially purchased. That first hit would be huge. since men like Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, Elon Musk of Tesla, and Jeff Bezos of Amazon sit on vast shares of the companies they created, which initially had a value of zero. After that, anybody with $1 billion in assets or who received $100 million in earnings for three consecutive years would face an annual tax on the gains in value of their publicly traded assets, whether or not they were sold.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Midstream.
The Israeli occupation forces face a real challenge in the city and camp of Jenin, up north of the city, where the Israeli aggression is being met with the form of resistance that scares Israel the most, live bullets and homemade Molotov instead of the good old rocks. The last of these clashes occurred at dawn last Monday when the occupation forces infiltrated to arrest a Palestinian young man, but an armed clash erupted, resulting in the martyrdom of five Palestinians. Activists in the camp made their stand very clear as they announced that resistance fighters from all factions are ready to clash with the Israeli army whenever they storm their camp. Since September 6, the West Bank and Gaza Strip have gone through daily confrontations and clashes between Palestinian natives and the Israeli occupation after the heroic escape of the six Palestinian detainees from the Gilboa prison. In the city of Jenin in the northern West Bank, in retaliation to the continuous Israeli aggression, dozens of shootings targeted Al Jalama checkpoint, homemade bombs were thrown, and bullets targeted an Israeli military occupation camp in the Mount Gerizim in Nablus. Also, dozens of clashes involved stones and Molotov cocktails took place in different parts of the West Bank. Anger mounted in the Palestinian streets after Israel recaptured and tortured four of the hero detainees, especially Zakaria Zubaydi, the former commander of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, who ended up with a fracture in the face due to the Israeli brutality. All Palestinian factions praised the escalated confrontations in Al-Quds and the West Bank, considering them as the only option to force Israel to end its violations against the Palestinian natives and those illegally held as captives in Israeli detention centers. Meanwhile, former commander of the Jenin unit in the occupation army, Yair Falau, confirmed that the city of Jenin and its camp still houses the nucleus of the Palestinian resistance in the occupied territories. This statement comes 20 years after the invasion carried out by the occupation army against the city and the West Bank under the name of the Defensive Wall. Falau suggested that the occupation army may carry out Operation Defensive Wall 2 within 6 months to a year if the situation continues as it is in Jenin. Yes, there is no comparison between the capabilities of the Israeli occupation forces and those of the resistance. But the will of the people and resistance fighters who have been going through hard times cannot be broken. They do not fear any threat. The Israeli army might be ready to storm the camp, awaiting a political decision, yet the resistance fighters in the camp will make them pay for it. Any price, no matter how low it is, will shake the Bennett government. This army cannot stand the killing of one or two of its occupation soldiers. We'll figure what happens if scores of them start falling. The world has witnessed in front row seats the current generation in the occupied territories defending Palestine. Natives of Al-Quds and Jenin camp do not have any fears and are ready for any Israeli aggression. The proof is that they daily go to the Al-Jalama checkpoint and clash with the occupation. They are not waiting for the occupation to storm the camp. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Now, in the West Bank, the Israeli occupation forces face a real challenge in the city of Jenin in the north, where they are met with retaliatory live bullets rather than rocks, as in other areas when Zionists storm the rest of the West Bank. They are faced usually with stones being thrown at them by young men, but in Jenin, natives fire live ammunition at the occupation forces and armed clashes erupt. The last of these clashes occurred at dawn last Monday when the occupation forces penetrated to arrest the Palestinian youth and an armed clash erupted, resulting in the death of five Palestinians. It was not enough killings for Israelis that they later on Thursday morning, they killed a 30-year-old mother of four, Isra Huzaima, near Bab al-Silsila, a gate in occupied Al-Quds. Now, Isra, who is from southern Jenin, was accused without evidence by the Israeli occupation forces that she was trying to stab one of the soldiers. The city of Jenin and its camp still possesses the nucleus of Palestinian resistance in the occupied territories after 20 years of the invasion carried out by the occupation army on the city and the West Bank under the name of the Protective Fence. Now, this fence is falling apart, and Jenin will be the first to crush it. To discuss this issue with us from the occupied West Bank is Dr. Amal Wahdan, human rights advocate and member of the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Amal. Now, dozens of Palestinian gunmen roam the streets of the West Bank, especially the Jenin refugee camp in the northern West Bank, that they say that they are ready to repel any kind of Israeli aggression or invasion against the camp. They've been called for a joint operation. All factions inside the camp called for a joint operation for the first time in many, many years. It includes the military wings affiliated with the National Liberation Movement, Fatah, with the Islamic Resistance, Hamas, and with the Islamic Jihad as well. Now, clashes have led recently to the martyrdom of several Palestinian young men and women. How has that affected the morale of the people inside of the camp?
Thank you, Marwa, for having me. Of course, it's affecting the morale of the people in Jenin, and it's not only Jenin. It's affecting the people of Palestine inside and outside the occupied territories. So any defiance for the Israeli occupation army and forces is actually a unifying stance by all the people and packed by all the people. Jenin refugee camp is considered to be liberated, as we call it, as the militant from the joint operation room is calling it, because the Israelis cannot enter the camp and cannot go with military forces to arrest anybody within the camp, even in the surrounding villages of Jenin. Any entrance or any insurgent by the Israeli military forces is going to be confronted with joint operation room, with joint militants from different Palestinian resistance groups to fight these Israelis. So it's not something that is going to be away by the Israeli wishes or even by any insurgent by the Israeli military forces. It's going to be defied, it's going to be resisted, and it's going to be actually causing them lots of casualties if they dare to enter the camp or to enter any of the villages.
Well, Dr. Ahmad, we heard from a former commander of the Jenin unit in the occupation army. He said his name is Yad Flau, and he confirmed that the city of Jenin and its camp, it still possesses the nucleus of the resistance of the occupied territories in occupied Palestine. And he somehow threatened that there will be a new defensive war. He called it Operation Defensive World 2. Might happen again, similar to the one that happened in 2002, within 6 months to a year, if the situation continues as is in Jenin camp. Now, is this just cheap talk by this Falau person, or actually, because he's expected to be soon the commander of the Golani brigade in the army, or is Israel actually ready to commit a new genocide?
Well, committing genocide is the pattern, is the process of this colonial apartheid entity since day one, even before 1948. So we wouldn't be surprised if they carry on any genocide against any of the Palestinian communities in the West Bank or Jerusalem. But the thing is, if we want to compare what happened 20 years ago and now in terms of accumulation of power, accumulation of willingness to defy the Israelis, even in the ability of the militants to fight the Israeli Israeli insurgents or invasion, and if we compare what happened to the Israeli side after 20 years, we can see that the balance of power now is weighing towards the Palestinian resistance, the Palestinian militant.
Well, the observers of the conditions of Jenin camp and Al-Quds are believing that the Jenin camp right now looks a lot like the besieged Gaza Strip, which the Israeli army is unable to invade, just like you said right now. Now, reports suggest that the resistance fighters from different areas of the West Bank actually arrived into Jenin camp in trying to prevent the invasion and preparing for a battle against the Israeli enemy. What are the odds of a joint Gaza/occupied territories operation in the event that Israel actually goes and invades Jenin camp, for example?
Well, that's the thing. If they dare to invade the Jenin refugee camp, I am sure that the resistance in Gaza will also stand up with Jenin and the rest of the West Bank as well. Remember that we still have the popular resistance everywhere, mm-hmm. and we witnessed what happened in Beit Anan, Jerusalem, over a week ago when they invaded one of the villages in Jerusalem, and the militants stood up for them. Of course, they were more in numbers, and it cost us two martyrs, actually, but at the end, the will of the people to resist the occupation is increasing and is accelerating.
That brings to mind a very important question, since we have one more minute left. How do you think the PA, the Palestinian Authority, will deal in the situation in case there is an escalation inside of Jenin and the popular resistance goes up stands in the face of the occupation?
Actually, Al-Aqsa Brigade had chosen their side. They're with the resistance, and they are together with the other factions in the military operation room. So the PA has no choice except to stand by the resistance. Otherwise, it will be looking, really, it will look very bad in front of the eyes of the people, of the Palestinians here. They do not have any choice except to support the resistance, to support their Aqsa Brigade.
Well,
so
it looks that
that's the national, that's the national stance that they should take if they want to stay in power a little bit longer.
Thank you very much, Dr. Amal Wahdan, human rights advocate and member of the Global Gathering in support of the choice of the resistance, for being with us. And whether Palestine resists or not, we stand by the side of Palestine and by the right to defend their own soil and their liberties. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about how Bahrain opened a new Israeli embassy and how the population, the public, is revolting against it.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts.
First official visit by an Israeli minister, Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid, inaugurated the Israeli embassy in Manama and met the Bahraini King Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa. Now, the official Bahraini news agency reported that King Hamad reviewed with Lapid the course of bilateral relations and the steps that contributed to the strengthening areas of cooperation between the two countries in light of the signing of the Declaration of Support for Peace and the Abraham Accord Agreement. Yes. He said peace, while Palestine just held several different funeral processions last week alone for the natives that were killed by the occupation's bullets. No shame whatsoever. The visit of the Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid to Bahrain can be summed up in one word: treason. This is how the Bahraini people feel about it, and how every Arab, Muslim, and free soul on this planet actually feels. No king, emir, or president will ever be able to remove Palestine from the hearts and minds of the people, and they will all never wash the stain of this crime from their hands. Al-Khalifa regime betrays Palestine in this following report.
Demonstrations against normalization continue in Bahrain, coinciding with the visit of the Israeli entity's foreign minister, Yair Lapid, voicing their refusal to open an Israeli embassy on their soil. The Bahraini security forces had suppressed similar demonstrations in the capital, Manama, and in several cities after they roamed the streets condemning normalization during the past week. On the day of the visit, Bahraini National Initiative Against Normalization affirmed its complete rejection of normalization with the usurping entity. The initiative considered in a statement under the title No Welcome to the Occupying Criminal that Lapid's desecration of Bahrain's land comes in light of the strong rejection of the proud Bahraini people who remain loyal to their central cause, pointing out that the Palestinian cause is the compass of the conflict in the region and that the Israeli entity is a satanic seed that has been planted in the side of the Arab world to keep the latter in a state of permanent depletion, keeping it away from progress, development, and prosperity. The initiative called on the authorities of Bahrain to immediately stop slipping towards normalization, which constitutes a stab in the back of the Palestinian people and its active forces and its militant factions, calling on all groups of the Bahraini people to renew their rejection of this normalization with the enemy and to continue to stand by the Palestinian people and support them in order to liberate their land and establish their independent national state on their entire national territory with Al-Quds as their official capital. Meanwhile, all Palestinian factions and pro-resistance factions across the Arab and Islamic world condemned this act of normalization by the Bahraini rogue regime, summing up the visit of the Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid to Bahrain in one word: treason. All the while, Bahrain's King Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa blatantly considered that his country's normalization with the Israeli occupation entity is a, quote, historic achievement that contributes to advancing the peace and stability process in the Middle East, end quote. The king's brazen remarks came as Palestine held seven different funeral processions for natives killed by the occupation's bullets during the same week of the Israeli foreign minister's visit to his country to open the notorious embassy on Bahraini soil.
Now to discuss this issue with us from London is Mr. Ali Al-Fayez, Bahraini activist. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Al-Fayez. Now, rogue regimes in multiple Arab countries that had normalized ties with the Israeli entity are pinning their hopes on the U.S., eyeing to please Washington by this kind of normalization, the last of which was actually Bahrain, when it welcomed Israeli foreign minister, as we just saw in the report, Yair Lapid, who inaugurated an Israeli embassy in Manama and met with the Bahraini king, Hamad bin Isa Al-Khalifa. Does the king not care whatsoever about the public sentiment in this matter? I mean, is he not concerned about his nation's security in any way possible?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you for inviting me. Well, you just said that the Sarud regime, the Al-Khalifa regime, have no legitimacy whatsoever. And the king, so-called king, the ruler of Bahrain, is taking decision on behalf of himself and his family, not on behalf of the people. The people, is against the normalization of the Zionist entity. And our people have protested on the street for the past days, flagging the opposition to such step. Now, when we talk about security and stability, Al-Khalifa does not look at the stability of the country and security of Bahrain, but they look at the security of their regime, the Al-Khalifa ruling regime, and they believe it will be more secured with the relationship with this entity, the Zionist entity, as there is a step from the United States to leave Middle East soon.
Well, Mr. Al-Fayez, the February 14 Revolution Youth Coalition in Bahrain denounced the planned visit of the Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid to Bahrain, holding the Bahraini regime responsible for the consequences of the visit. Now, the coalition also emphasized the need for all forms of resistance against normalization until the concluded normalization agreements are canceled completely with the entity. Can this be understood as a mobilization for the first armed resistance in Bahrain? That's just me asking, because I read it and read it again, and I was like, well, this is new. What do you think?
Well, the leadership of Bahrain movement, Ayatollah Sheikh Isa Ahmed Qasim, decision until this moment is to stay peaceful. Now, this with regard to the democratic transformation that the opposition and the people of Bahrain demanded for the past 10 years, actually more than 10 years, but since the 14th of Feb revolution. Now, with the Zionist regime being in the picture and the equation, this could change the whole equation. But 14 of the coalition or other movement, they have always such option on the table, but they will not take it in a practice unless it's decided by Ayatollah Sheikh Isa Ahmed Qasim. We will resist politically, we will resist on the media, we will resist on the ground by protesting, but mobilization of armed resistance is a decision of Ayatollah Sheikh Isa Ahmed Qasim, and I would advise everyone to read his statements and to follow
what he is saying, because he could take a decision if that's needed to secure Bahrain and the interest of this ummah, the Arabic and Islamic ummah.
Well, Palestine viewed this visit as an encouragement of Israeli crimes against its people. Mind you, on the same week which the visit actually happened, there were seven Palestinian natives that were killed with live bullets by the Israeli entity, one of which actually a 30-year-old mother of four in the occupied Al-Quds. After such humiliating normalization, what role do these puppet regimes think that they can play to protect Palestine, as they always say they are doing?
Well, that's a fake statement. They always say it change the direction of their agenda. Their agenda is to have a relationship with Israel, the Zionist entity, the Zionist regime at this point of time.